Thank you, Brett, for that extraordinarily generous introduction and also for the chance to come here for the first time, too, not just to MSU and to Bozeman, but also to Montana as well. So it's really wonderful to be here, despite all the best efforts of Delta Airlines from preventing me from getting here, having sprinted across Minneapolis Airport, seemingly half of Minnesota to get here. I'm really, really glad to be here. It's also wonderful to see one's students doing so well, since Brett was sitting in my class last year, really coming along nicely, I think. And they produce a book within a year. I mean, this is what every teacher wants to see. So really fantastic to be here, really fantastic to see friends old and new. And thank you so much for coming out this evening. Now, many of us, I think, can remember a moment not so very long ago when history was supposed to end. In the years after 1989, we were told the free market was going to supplant every other form of economic organization. Its elective affinity with democracy would ensure that all other forms of politics would succumb to its advance. Globalization was going to create a borderless world of unlimited prosperity and unassailable human rights. Progress would reach its consummation in a Kantian utopia of perpetual peace. As we all know, history bit back, and with a vengeance. It was apparently just drawing breath before springing back into action and with ever more unsettling energy. Mercantilism seems to be returning to slam globalization in reverse in the economic sphere. The historically brief alliance, as it now seems, between liberalism and democracy is also looking like it's coming apart at the seams. And the world is obviously still a very violent place. States are mostly at peace with each other, to be sure. But after 1989, wars within states have become the most widespread, the most destructive, and, we might now say, the most characteristic form of organized human violence. In 2015, the last year for which we have reliable figures, in 2015, there were 50 armed conflicts in progress around the world from Afghanistan to Yemen. And that total doesn't include acts of terrorism, insurgency, or other forms of so-called asymmetrical warfare in which non-state forces battle states or their inhabitants. The activities first of Al-Qaeda and now of Islamic State have brought the weaponry of war onto the streets of the world's cities, from Manhattan to Mumbai, and from Sydney and San Bernardino to Brussels and Paris. Amid this violence, there was only one armed conflict between two states in 2015, and that's still the case, I think, as we speak now. That is between India and Pakistan in their border dispute over Kashmir. And in 2015, that particular dispute between two states had fewer than 30 casualties. So some historians and other students of world affairs have called this the long peace since 1945, this gradual decline in war between states, but that has not led to a decline in absolute violence around the world. It's almost flipped violence around from violence between states to violence within states. So far from what one student of the subject has called the better angels of our nature, winning the war upon war, a long peace among states has stood under a dark shadow, the shadow of civil war. The global estimate of battle deaths in these civil wars since 1945 is over 25 million people. That is about half the estimated direct casualties in the Second World War itself. But that count doesn't include civilians, the wounded, the displaced, or those who die from the knock-on effects of civil war, such as disease and malnutrition. If we look beyond the human toll of civil war, devastating though that's been, to the material and economic costs of this form of conflict, the impact has been no less appalling. Think not only of the 500,000 Syrians killed since 2011, but also of the more than half of that country's population civil war has displaced either internally or externally. Civil wars cost lives and a great many lives indeed, but they also waste resources. They divert spending from welfare to warfare, they disrupt economies, they foment crime and disease, and suppress economic productivity, often for decades after a civil conflict. The hard-nosed economists who study global development calculate an annual price tag for civil wars at about $123 billion a year. That is roughly the equivalent of the amount the global north budgets for economic aid to the global south. Not without reason, then, has civil war been chillingly described as development in reverse. How are we to make sense of such mayhem? Normally, under some circumstances, we might turn to social and political theory or philosophy for intellectual resources and concepts to grapple with such a challenge. Yet when it comes to civil war, we look in vain. There's no great work called On Civil War to stand alongside, say, Clausewitz's famous work On War or Hannah Arendt's book On Revolution. Indeed, Clausewitz hardly ever discussed civil war in his whole vast oeuvre on war, and Hannah Arendt dismissed it along with war itself as atavistic, backward-looking, anti-modern, unlike revolution, her subject. In the words of one recent theorist, there exists today a theory of war and a theory of peace, but there is no theory of civil war. I think our own age demands an unblinking encounter with civil war, and if theory cannot help, then perhaps history can. One consistent message from history concerns the horror of civil war. War is hell, the US Civil War general William Tecumseh Sherman is supposed to have said, but surely the only thing worse is civil war. On that fact, there's been general agreement across the centuries. Civil wars are felt to be more destructive than wars against external enemies. As the first century BCE Roman poet Lucan wrote in the wake of Rome's civil wars about the shattered cities, the abandoned fields, and the displaced people those wars had left behind, he said, "No foreign sword has penetrated so. It is wounds inflicted by the hand of fellow citizens that have sunk so deep." Civil wars have often been compared to a sickness of the body politic, eating it away from within. In this vein, the late 16th century French essayist Michel de Montaigne warned his readers during the French Wars of Religion, "In truth, a foreign war is nothing so dangerous a disease as a civil war." Civil wars have often been held to be morally degrading. So, just to take one example, before the Irish Civil War of 1922, an elderly priest lamented, quotes, "War with the foreigner brings to the fore all that is best and noblest in a nation. Civil war, all that is mean and base. And civil wars leave wounds that will not heal. I question whether any serious civil war ever does end," wrote the poet T.S. Eliot in 1947. And the former French president, Charles de Gaulle, agreed with him on a visit to Spain in 1970 when de Gaulle said, this is just after, of course, the Spanish Civil War and during the Franco regime, "All wars are bad," de Gaulle said, "but civil wars in which there are brothers in both trenches are unforgivable because peace is not born when the war concludes." Long-lived as well as the reputation of civil war as the most destructive of all kinds of human conflicts. Just a few raw numbers could illustrate this. So at the height of Rome's civil wars in the first century BCE, perhaps a quarter of all its male citizens aged between 17 and 46 were in arms at some point. Fast forward 1,700 years to the middle of the 17th century, and probably a greater proportion of England's population died during the civil wars of the 1640s than would later perish in the First World War. Two centuries later still, the combined death toll from both sides in the US Civil War has been calculated as 750,000 people from both North and South. That, too, is higher than the casualty rate for the US during the Second World War and would be roughly equivalent to about 7.5 million deaths among the current US population, if we scale that up to the size of the population now. Slaughter on such a scale scythed through families, shattered communities, shaped nations, and scarred imaginations for centuries to come. I do, however, want us to be cautious about the idea that civil war is somehow an inevitable part of our human makeup, a feature, as we might say, not a bug in the software that makes us human. That, I think, would be to doom us to suffer civil war ad infinitum. To unsettle the notion that we might be condemned somehow to interminable civil war In my book, I brought historical tools to bear on the challenge of this unsettling form of human activity. I argue that civil war was neither eternal nor is it inexplicable. It has a history with an identifiable beginning, if not yet quite a discernible end. This historical treatment reveals the contingency of civil war to combat those who might assume its permanence and its durability. What humans have invented, I argue, they may yet dismantle. What has been created through an effort of intellectual will can be demolished by a similar effort of imaginative determination. The book is the first long-range history of civil wars from their beginnings in Republican Rome all the way up to the present in the Middle East and South Asia. Over 2,000 years, as it were, from Sulla, one of the generals in the First Roman Civil War, all the way up to Syria. My goal is to point up the significance of civil war in forming the ways in which we think about the world. I argue that despite its obvious and horrendous destructiveness, civil war has been throughout history paradoxically also very generative in terms of concepts and ideas and arguments. Without the challenges posed by civil war, I argue, our conceptions of politics, authority, revolution, international law, humanitarianism, and globalization, to take just a few, would have been quite different, perhaps even strangely poorer. The experience of civil war, the efforts to understand it, to ameliorate it, and even ultimately to prevent it, continues to inform our ideas of community, authority, and sovereignty to this very day. More than most other forms of conflict, civil wars spring from deep and deadly divisions, but at the same time, they also expose identities and commonalities. To call a war civil is to acknowledge the familiarity of the enemies against whom one is fighting. It comes from the Roman word, the Latin word, cives, citizens. From that we get civil, from that we get words like civility and civilization, but we also get civil war, a war between citizens, a war among fellow citizens. And I think that's the paradox at the very heart of civil war, that we recognize our commonality with the people we're fighting, even at the moment of deepest division. This was captured by the German legal thinker Carl Schmitt early in the 20th century, where he said, "Civil war has something atrocious about it." As he went on, "It's fraternal war. It's conducted within a common political unit, and both warring sides at the same time absolutely affirm and absolutely deny this common unit." And I think that's one of the basic source of our horror about civil wars, that we recognize commonality amid confrontation. Civil war, in this sense, makes us see ourselves in the very mirror of enmity. And this is why so much of the imagery of civil war is about brother against brother, families divided, the idea almost of looking into the eyes of someone who is part of your own family, even down the barrel of a gun or even at the point of a sword. And that captures the real, the intimate horror, the familiar horror, the familial horror even of civil war. Now, one reason I argue in the book that civil war has paradoxically been so fertile for thinking with is because there's never been a time when its definition was settled to everyone's satisfaction or when the term could be used without question or contention. And this goes back 2,000 years, and in the latter part of this lecture I'll show how this fact is still very much with us. Civil war has been disputed and debated within many different historical contexts across time, some of which I try to touch down on and bring out in the course of the book. Naming, I argue, is always a form of framing. The application of the term civil war can depend upon whether you are a ruler or a rebel, the victor or the vanquished, an established government or an interested outside party in a conflict. Indeed, the battle over names can continue long after a conflict has ceased. For example, even now, using the term civil war to describe the struggle between the Italian resistance and the fascist government during World War II remains controversial in Italy because, for some, it implies an equivalence, a moral equivalence even, between the two sides in that struggle. The very language of civil war can arouse passions even when the embers of conflict have long since cooled. For example, in 2004, former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Newt Gingrich, described American politics as if it were a civil war in words that now seem prophetic for our own moment. This is Newt Gingrich just over a decade ago. Consider the source. The left, at its core, understands in a way Grant understood after Shiloh that this is a civil war, that only one side will prevail and the other side will be relegated to history. He then went on to sketch out the terms of this battle as he saw it. This war, he said, has to be fought with the scale and duration and savagery that is only true of civil wars. While we are lucky in this country that our civil wars are fought at the ballot box, not on the ballot fields, not on the battlefields, nonetheless, it is a civil war. More recently, just to take an example from the other side of the Atlantic, in the aftermath of the ISIS attack on Paris in November 2015, then French Prime Minister Manuel Valls charged that the right-wing Front National was stirring up civil war in France. As he said then, there are two options for our country. The option of the extreme right, which basically foments division that can lead to civil war, and then another vision, the vision of the French Republic and its values, which brings people together. Just scanning the headlines over the past few months, there was a civil war in the British Tory Party after the vote on the Brexit referendum. The British Labour Party seems to be in a continual civil war at the moment. Republicans were said to be in a civil war during the nomination process before the last election. There was a civil war around the voting around the Affordable Care Act a few weeks ago. And even, I think, just 2 days ago on the front page of the Washington Post, the president was supposed to be wading into a civil war within the GOP. I think this use of metaphor is not at all insignificant. There's a ramping up of this language, as Brett suggested in his opening remarks, which is very worrying just as an index of the way in which we're thinking about partisanship, political division, the impossibility of bridging divides, the difficulty of speaking to one another across those divides, and the leakage of violence in language and then even perhaps in physical violence that's worrying so many of us at the moment. Increasingly, I argue in the book, using some of these examples, increasingly around the world, democratic politics itself seems increasingly to be civil war by other means. Civil wars are everywhere, in the headlines and on the ground, in hearts and minds, and in commemorations of civil wars past. As the Vietnamese writer Viet Thanh Nguyen has recently written, quotes, "All wars are fought twice, the first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory." And that's especially true of civil wars. Some countries have imagined themselves free of civil war, but others can hardly imagine themselves without a memory of civil war. The United States, for one. Think, just to take one example, of the continuing battles over the Confederate battle flag in parts of the United States. That's a sign that in some ways the embers, the ashes, even of a conflict fought 150 years ago, have not entirely cooled in this country. The international community perceives still other civil wars, in Iraq, for example, as a perpetual battleground of unending civil wars, like those from the past, from Rome, from England, from other countries and states across history. In each case, there seems to be little doubt about what is and what is not civil war. Everyone seems to know what civil war is when they see it. But the benefit of some history, and perhaps the curse of remembering civil war, is the knowledge that civil war has never been quite as stable or transparent a category as its use in popular speech would imply. In order to show this, my book examines this key idea in Western and global thought in multiple historical contexts. And it does so in particular as a history of a key concept deriving from ancient Rome. The Romans alone, I argue, bore the guilt of inventing civil war. The Greeks had very different terms in which to think about it, not as civil war, but as quite different things. I can talk about that if you're interested, but I really take this as beginning with Rome, and the Romans knew that they were talking about something that was quantitatively and qualitatively different from anything that had been fought before. And that's one reason I argue that this was an invention. It wasn't something internal to humanity itself. Not all roads lead from Rome in the formation of our modern political vocabulary, but a great many do. Among them, some of the most enduring ideas in the modern lexicon, liberty, empire, property, rights, these are all ultimately Roman-derived terms, also civil war for that matter. conflict over the meaning of civil war, as much as the meaning of this kind of conflict, are prime subjects for historical treatment. And that's what I've tried to unfold over the course of 2,000 years in just under 300 pages. So it's a fast ride, but gets you quickly from one place to the other, and I hope is illuminating along the journey as well. To tell that story, I break the book into three parts, each of two chapters. The first part I call Roads from Rome, which traces changing conceptions of civil war from the 1st century BCE to the 5th century CE, so over six centuries. During that period, I argue, Roman conceptions decisively shaped arguments about civil war, about its normative and legal definition, about how to recognize civil war, about where it came from, about the likelihood of it coming back again and again, as the Romans discovered. They were never free of civil war. They often compared civil wars to volcanoes, which would grow dormant and then erupt again, dormant and then erupt. All roads led from Rome in this story, I argue, but not back from Athens and, say, the world of Thucydides, because among the Greeks, conflict within the community was understood very differently from these ideas of civil war that the Romans invented. The Roman heritage itself contained many different explanations of civil war and transmitted a host of competing narratives of its place in Roman history, which were influential at least up to the 19th century, even into the early 20th century. Civil war was not a fact of nature waiting to be discovered. It was an artifact of human culture that had to be created. The creation, the invention of civil war, is only a little over 2,000 years old and can be dated quite precisely to the 1st century BCE. The first people to understand their acts of collective violence as both civil and as war were, as I've said, the Romans. They always named their conflicts after the enemy they were fighting, in this case, again, fighting against their fellow citizens. However, because the Romans believed a war could only be just if it was fought against an external enemy, these internal enemies were uniquely unsettling because, by definition, not being outsiders, not being others, as we might say, they should have been the people to whom one were closest, and so there's something paradoxical at the very heart of that Roman idea of civil war, to be fighting a war which should be fought against someone outside, against the people who are definitely inside the community. A war, in this sense for the Romans, which could not, by their definitions, be a war, fought against enemies who, again, were not really enemies. The Romans, therefore, adopted the idea of civil war reluctantly at first, and for a long time they used it only with trepidation. We can see this most graphically in the case of that famed civil warrior and historian Julius Caesar himself. He narrated his power struggle with his rival Pompey in a work now known simply as The Civil War, one of his most famous writings. But the title was not his, and if you look at the text itself, he only ever uses the word civil war in the mouths of other people in the text itself, only twice, in fact, and he will never use those words to describe the conflict. We can also see this in perhaps the most famous moment in the whole of Caesar's career, the moment when he crosses the River Rubicon, a term that we still use as a metaphor for an irreversible political or military step. Again, if you read Caesar's account of that crossing over, in fact, it was a crossing over from the sphere of the military authority with his army into the sphere of civilian authority within the city of Rome itself. If you read his own account, we don't see, there's no verb, there's no description of his army moving across the River Rubicon to mark that shift. They just magically appear on the other side. He can't bring himself to talk about that move from one side to the other, which initiated civil war at that point. The enormity of civil war helps to explain why Romans were so reticent in giving it a name and why they remained reluctant to use that name long after its invention. For Caesar, as for many other Romans, civil war was the war that dared not speak its name. Yet there also emerged an enduring and disturbing strain of Roman history that suggested a tight relationship between civil war and civilization itself. Civil wars came back so often across the history of Rome and the Roman Empire that they appeared to Rome's inhabitants to be woven into the very fabric of Roman public life itself. They created a set of narratives of a civilization prone to civil war, even cursed by it, that would last for centuries and later inform understandings of civil war across early modern and modern Europe and beyond. Indeed, I argue in the book, for more than a millennium and a half, civil war was viewed through Rome-tinted spectacles. As I go on to show in the second part of the book, which I call Early Modern Crossroads, those Roman explanations and their narratives provided the repertoire from which later thinkers in Europe between the 16th and 19th centuries drew their own conceptions of civil war. Over the palimpsest of civil war, the Roman narratives, would soon be written a new narrative, beginning in the late 18th century, a narrative not of these destructive conflicts, but rather of transformative revolutions. And during the 18th century, I show these two sets of concepts, civil war on the one hand, revolution on the other, were in a very interesting and dangerous relationship with each other. For some, civil war was inevitably backward-looking, calamitous, regressive, while revolution emerged as future-oriented, fertile, and progressive. And successful civil wars came to be rebranded as revolutions. Take, for example, what we now call the American Revolution. That's a term that only begins to emerge in the late 1770s, but in the early part of the conflict, especially in the early to mid part of the 1770s, both sides, and indeed on both sides of the Atlantic, that conflict is called a civil war among fellow Britons around the Atlantic world. And indeed, I think the very first usage of the term American Civil War I found is from 1774 to describe what we would now call the War of Independence. So that's the first American Civil War happening at that point. Of course, again, this successful revolution, successful civil war, becomes retrospectively rebranded as a revolution. It's very hard now, except for people like me. You might have guessed from the accent that I wasn't born American. I am an American citizen, but also a Brit. For Americans to think of that as a civil war, it's a local civil war in places like New York and South Carolina, where this kind of familial community-based conflict takes place on the ground. But it's also a war among fellow Britons, those who until the very last minute still think of themselves, as Thomas Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence, as British brethren. Even in the heart of that document, which is splitting the colonies from Britain itself, even Jefferson still talks about the people on the other side as fellow brethren. That's a sign of that enduring civil war orientation of that. And this difference between civil war and revolution, I think, allows us to think of a verb conjugation. I am a revolutionary, you are a rebel, but they are fighting a civil war. The third part of the book I call Paths to the Present, tracing the conceptual heritages of civil war from the era of the US Civil War up to our own time in the 21st century. The 19th century's great contribution to the history of ideas of civil war, I argue, was the attempt to civilize civil war, to bring it under the domain of law, beginning with the first modern codification of the laws of war by a Prussian, later an American, Francis Lieber, in the 1860s, who wrote the first codification of the laws of war for the Union Army in 1863, and in that gave the first full-throated legal definition of civil war, which was enormously influential. First in the Hague and Geneva Conventions in the late 19th century, codifying the laws of war in a European and later a global context, but also in American military doctrine, at least up to the Second World War as well. Civilizing civil war, bringing civil war under the domain of the laws of war, of international law, of what we now call international humanitarian law, has remained as a task for the international legal community right down to our own time. And I argue that the roots of their concern about civil war and the tensions it's raised within what we now call international humanitarian law find their roots in this 19th century moment, and in particular in the US Civil War. I trace developments as civil war goes global across the course of the 20th century. The boundaries of the community within which civil wars took place expanded beyond those of states or even empires to encompass the whole world in an idea of global civil war, a term that begins to emerge during the early 1960s, not at all coincidentally during the early years of the Cold War, when the Cold War itself is cast by various thinkers, including John F. Kennedy, for instance, in his Second State of the Union address, as a global civil war, dividing the whole of humanity into ideological blocks, a cold civil war, indeed, of a very different kind from the one that Simon Sharma has described, as Brett noted. That expansion of the boundaries of civil war to encompass the whole of humanity, I argue, has deep strains in various, deep roots in various strains of cosmopolitan thinking, which had long suggested that all wars among human beings were indeed civil wars because fought among fellow humans. Yet that idea of global civil war also collided with a late 20th century effort, beginning again in the Cold War, by social scientists to bring some conceptual clarity to the study of civil war, starting during the era of anti-colonial wars in the 1960s. And I'll come back to that in just one moment, because the heritage of that moment in the 1960s still has resonances and consequences in places like Iraq and Syria, for instance. The debates over the meaning, the application, the parameters, the definitions of civil war make their way into the intellectual DNA of international organizations like the World Bank and the United Nations and the International Committee of the Red Cross to this day. And I believe, as I'll show in a moment, that they're the cause of much of our own conceptual confusion about what is and what is not a civil war. This sedimented conceptual history of civil war, going back to Rome and layered over since with languages of law, the social sciences, history, and poetry, gives rise to the complexity in our current understandings. What I want to do in the last few minutes of this talk is to illustrate the consequences of that historical layering with two linked examples, the first from beginning in the 1960s and the second coming from the early 2000s. I started working on this book actually in early 2007 at the height of the Iraq War, when 3,000 to 4,000 people a month were dying in Iraq in the aftermath of the US-led invasion. At that point, as I'll show in a moment, there was a political debate about what words to describe that particular conflict. Was it an insurgency or a rebellion or a civil war? I was reading that debate in the newspapers at the time while also reading the correspondence of Francis Lieber, whom I've just mentioned. He was having terrible trouble defining civil war. In 1863, there was a battle going on about the definition of civil war in 2007. This is what historians, with a nod to Mark Twain, call history rhyming, when you see two things very far apart from each other which have a connection or seem to have some resonance with each other. And that's often when a historian begins to think there's a larger story to be told about why those two things link up, and that's where this book began. So let me take you back just very briefly to the early 1960s and then forward to that moment in 2006-2007. In the early 1960s, a large project called the Correlates of War Project was founded at the University of Michigan. This was a systematic attempt by a group of social scientists to measure the incidence of conflict around the globe by the accumulation and analysis of data on all wars since 1816, so going back at that point, not quite 200 years. It's still ongoing now, so it now covers more than 200 years. The project initially had focused on interstate conflict, but they very soon discovered that it needed to deal with other kinds of conflict, including civil wars, insurgencies, and foreign interventions. Now, of course, this was a very computer-heavy project driven by data, and like any such project, you need some discriminations. What goes into which database, what goes into which other part of it. So they had to elaborate a definition of civil war, and I'll just give you that now. Sustained military combat, primarily internal, resulting in at least 1,000 battlefield deaths per year, pitting central government forces against an insurgent force capable of inflicting upon the government forces at least 5% of the fatalities the insurgents sustain. There will be a test after this lecture, so I hope you got that. They called this a deceptively straightforward definition. It was designed to create a large enough sample to be meaningful, but also to exclude many conflicts that would have blurred their analysis. Civil war, just to take a couple of the criteria, civil war had to be militarized to distinguish it from other forms of internal violence, like riots and coup d'etat. It was only what they called primarily internal because it also had to encompass those civil wars which overflowed the borders of particular states or drew in outside fighters, what scholars call internationalized civil wars. The cutoff point that I mentioned of 1,000 battlefield deaths defined it as a major civil war rather than a skirmish or a smaller kind of insurgency, for instance. It had to be militarized on both sides to distinguish it from, say, a massacre or a genocide by a government of its people. You had to have both sides that were fully armed in that way. Now, we can think of many problems, and scholars over the years have thought of many problems with these definitions. One problem is the conflicts that would be excluded by it, for at least by some of their participants and observers and those who remember civil wars later on. For example, it would exclude the Swiss Sonderbund War of 1847. I'm sure we have many Swiss people in the room who remember the Swiss Sonderbund War of 1847. Perhaps the shortest civil war on record. It lasted only 25 days, and it had one of the lowest death tolls, only 93 people by the best count. But it was thought of very much at the time in Switzerland and in Europe, and it's still thought of in Switzerland as a civil war, but it wouldn't have reached that threshold. Perhaps more importantly, it would have excluded, say, the Irish Civil War after 1922, and it would also have excluded the Troubles later in Northern Ireland, in which the death toll was only around 3,500 people between 1969 and 2001. That is, over the whole course of what we think of as the Northern Irish Troubles. So the problems with that definition were not just academic. This became very clear during this moment I mentioned during the Second Gulf War, when precisely this definition was used to prove both that there was a civil war taking place within Iraq and that there was not. Towards the end of 2006-2007, at the height of the violence in Iraq, there was this vehement disagreement about whether or not the category of civil war fit the facts on the ground in Iraq. Representatives of the Bush administration at the time, the George W. Bush administration, and other mostly right-wing strategists and political pundits denied that the turbulence in Iraq merited the name of civil war. A terrorism, insurgency, perhaps, but a civil war, certainly not. During the course of that year, the eminent, very eminent British military historian and journalist Sir John Keegan wrote an article with an American commentator called Bartle Bull, in which they dismissed the term civil war to describe the violence in Iraq. For any conflict to earn the designation civil war, they argued, the violence must be civil and it must be war. Hope you got that. That's the really complicated definition. And they said, went on, its aim must either be the exercise or the acquisition of national power. That is, fought within a single state by organized bodies of combatants drawn from a single national population who use force either to grasp or to retain overall political authority within their territory. Of course, one big problem with that is it doesn't describe the US Civil War, which, unless I've missed something very fundamental about Confederate war aims, was not trying to take over the entire territory of the United States, but of course to secede from it and create an independent territory there. However, Keegan and Bull, using their definition, discovered that instances of civil war were historically extraordinarily rare and counted, indeed, only five such wars. The English Civil War of the 1640s, they did include the American Civil War of the 1860s, and then later they included the Russian Civil War, the Spanish Civil War, and the Civil War in Lebanon between 1975 and 1990. Around the same moment, an American sergeant with the 3rd U.S. Infantry Division in Baghdad, who also happened to have a doctorate in political science and was very familiar with these social science definitions, debunkingly deployed the very same definition that I quoted to you a moment ago from the Correlates of War project to show that Iraq, as he put it, had suffered seven separate civil wars in the last 45 years alone, a total spectacularly at odds with the five civil wars that Keegan and Bull had discovered in the whole span of modern history since the mid-17th century. As this debate over the violence in Iraq showed, there was no agreement about just which features of civil war take priority in its various definitions and the way in which they might be applied to specific conflicts. I argue in the book, using other examples, that all such attempts at precision in the use of the term civil war are doomed and illusory for the simple reason that civil war is what we call an essentially contested concept. Being precise in the sense of using clear definitions turns out always to be inescapably political and ideological rather than scientific or objective. The elements of these definitions, as much as their application, are always matters for principal dispute. And that seems especially true, not uniquely true, but especially true of civil war, an essentially contested concept about the essential elements of contestation itself. Now, a philosopher, a lawyer, perhaps even a political scientist, might see only confusion in such wrangling over the term civil war. But a historian, in this case, often scents opportunity. The task of the historian is not to come up with a better definition on which all sides could agree, but rather to ask where these competing conceptions come from, what they meant, and how they arose from the experience of those who lived through civil war or who attempted to understand it in the past. The stakes are indeed now very high for applying or withholding the label civil war to a conflict, and it's therefore unlikely that politics can ever be eliminated from its application. like the term genocide, indeed, civil war has not only political connotations but also legal implications that can trigger concern and action from the international community. And therefore, this choice of categories has moral and political consequences that can be a matter of life or death for tens of thousands of people, usually those least able to control how their own destinies are shaped. And I'll just conclude with one final example and then some morals to draw from this story. Let's take, just as that last example, the case of Syria, the ongoing conflict in Syria, which has, of course, been ramped up just in the last day. But we're going back to the very beginnings of that conflict in 2011, 2012. Ordinary Syrians knew very well throughout 2011, at the start of the conflict, that what they were experiencing with their the regime of Bashar al-Assad was indeed civil war. There's a lot of commentary and testimony of that at that moment. However, it took the International Committee of the Red Cross until July 2012, more than a year into the conflict, and after as many as 17,000 people had already died, to confirm that what was taking place in Syria was, in fact, a civil war, or they use the more technical language of international humanitarian law, which is an armed conflict, not of an international character, what you or I would call a civil war. Only when the Red Cross had made that determination did it become possible for the relevant parties to be covered by various provisions of the Geneva Conventions, allowing for humanitarian aid to come into the country, for data gathering about potential war crimes to take place, for instance. So this has real-world consequences, that external determination that a conflict is a civil war. This set of legal protocols, which have been designed in some ways to humanize the conduct of civil war, to bring to bear humanitarian constraints on its practice, to minimize some of the terrible human cost of civil conflict, in this case, I think, served only to constrain international actors in their attitudes towards Syria. Deciding whether what we see is indeed a civil war can therefore have political, military, legal, and economic consequences for those outside the war-torn country, but especially for those within it. The international community may acknowledge the existence of such a conflict in order to avoid involvement. A civil war, it's sometimes assumed, it's somebody else's business. It's happening internally. The rest of us should stay away from it. Conversely, the label can authorize intervention after a state has collapsed and a humanitarian crisis ensues. Think of Libya as a parallel example to Syria, for instance. As we've seen in these recent debates about the conflicts in Iraq and Syria, attempts to confine civil war within a single definition lead only to further complication and contestation. I think, as a historian, it's better to work from the other direction, to excavate the various meanings of civil war as they've been laid down over the centuries in order to understand why we're so confused and why, in a sense, we speak so many different languages and have these collisions between experience on the ground and the languages that are used by professionals, especially legal and political professionals in international organizations. Let me conclude just very briefly with some reflections on the purpose of this 2,000-year history in ideas of civil war. I think this long view of civil war can encourage humility, complexity, and, yes, hope. It may have been rather a depressing tour that I've given you now, but I want to end on a note of hope. Humility first. Humility because we can see that much of what we think we now know about civil wars was discovered centuries, even millennia ago. Social scientists, for instance, now tell us that civil wars last longer, recur more often, and leave deeper wounds than other kinds of conflict. But the Romans had discovered all of that during their own civil wars in the first century BCE and after, and in their reflections on those conflicts over five centuries, from Cicero to Saint Augustine. Secondly, complexity. Complexity because our own struggles over the meaning and significance of civil war arise from multiple histories that are still jostling and colliding here and now in the present. Controversies over the meaning of civil war arise from its multiple histories, which need to be carefully investigated to be properly understood. And finally, hope, at least a somewhat tempered hope. The long view shows that civil war is not a congenital curse for humanity, but an affliction that we might gradually cure, indeed be curing right now. The incidence of civil conflict in the 21st century finally seems to be declining around the world after peaking in the years after 1989. Major civil wars and very long-running civil wars, for example, the civil war in Sri Lanka, which had lasted for 26 years but ended in 2009, and more recently the civil war in Colombia, which had lasted more than 40 years, actually more than 50 years, 52 years, have lately been terminated after decades of death and destruction in those two countries. Indeed, the entire Western Hemisphere, all of the Americas, with the end of the Colombian Civil War, is now free from formal civil war for almost the first time in two centuries. Perhaps humanity may at last be on the verge of uninventing what the Romans had first invented over 2,000 years ago. Until we do, though, I believe we need history and a very long view of that history to assess the future prospects for escaping one of humanity's most destructive discontents. Thank you very much.